See, in right now, you see, the eels in this sort of water will be, if temperature's dropping below, I don't know what the water temperature is now, but it might be 9, 8, 7, but eels hibernate once it drops below that. They back up into the banks and go to sleep.
What, anchor themselves in?
Yes. Literally back in. They reverse in. And they just spend the winter like that in hibernated state. So the temperature drop really triggers the...
That's amazing.
The story.
So will they be doing that yet at this point?
They'll be now.
It'll be cold enough and they'll be in there.
I mean, downriver here, where you get lots and lots of eels, they tend to be males. So they'll be here only for, say, 10 years.
Yeah.
Whereas the ladies tend to go upstream more, where there are fewer eels.
Oh, really?
And then they spend more like 15 years in our temperatures to grow up.
I came across a weird fact that I thought they weren't really gendered until they swam back. Is that true?
No. They're not gendered until they choose their sex. And in our country, it's about year 4 or 5.
So we've come to a different part of Stuart Marshes, and we're standing now in front of a brackish pool with bulrushes and reeds at the bottom of a giant pylon that's stretching out into the horizon, and we've just seen a big flock of lapwings and golden plover fly overhead. And I'm standing here with the wonderful Andrew Carr, who is the chairman of the Sustainable Eel Group. The thing that drew me to eels in the first place, when I found, I feel like I had a moment of discovery when I learned about eels, was the epic journey that they have, and they travel across the world in huge numbers and at huge distances. Could you sort of describe their life cycle for us?
It's both a natural journey and an unnatural journey, but yes, they circumnavigate the globe. So they start off in the Sargasso Sea, that's at the bottom of the Bermuda Triangle, about 4,000 miles away, and they literally float on the Atlantic currents, moving slowly towards Europe. It takes a couple of years. Then they enter the rivers, into the freshwater rivers of Europe, west-flowing ones. Sometimes we help them to locations because 3/4 of them arrive in the Bay of Biscay. That's 3/4 of 1.3 billion, which is the annual arrival at the moment. 50 years ago, it had been 10 times that number.
Wow.
And then, of course, they're trying to grow up in our waters, heading back downstream again, and then they're trying to swim all the way back via the Azores. We've been satellite tagging them, but we haven't tagged them beyond the Azores yet. I did say circumnavigate the world, and I'll just carry on with that idea, because many of them are illegally caught and then put in suitcases on aeroplanes to go to Asia, where they're grown on in farms, and then they're sold to the Chinese and the Japanese. But they also get flown on again across the Pacific and then sold into the sushi markets of North America. So they do, in effect, some circumnavigate the entire world.
Inadvertently, wow. And one of the things that I've heard that is a problem for eels, as they make this journey, not just from the Sargasso Sea and across the Atlantic, but then transitioning from the saltwater to the freshwater and heading upstream, they're coming across obstacles.
Oh, yeah. Are they? There's something like 1.3 million barriers to fish migration in the rivers of Europe. And then there are 25,000 hydropower stations with their turbines, and turbines and eels don't mix. We've lost so much habitat. Here we are in a wetland, a restored wetland. We've lost, each country has a different figure, but 70 to 80% of the wetlands have been drained. And wetlands are like the supercritical habitat for eel, because they arrive and they have to metamorphosize from a saltwater to a freshwater fish. And they do that in their nursery habitats, which are wetlands. We didn't intend to make life difficult for the eels. We just engineered water for our needs, and we didn't think about nature. Now, having to put it right is so much more expensive than designing the solution in the beginning.
I did a day of conservation work down on the River Axe, actually, in North Somerset. And it was with an organisation called BART, Bristol Avon Rivers Trust. And we went down one night in February, and we were testing out methodology for catching them with nets in order to monitor them and then potentially put them on the other side of obstacles and see what the numbers were like. And I just remember getting these trays of these tiny glass eels, which had just arrived, see-through at that stage, and they looked like rice noodles, looked like kind of vermicelli, and you could see them wriggling around in your hand, and I just thought that this little scrap of life has come so far. The glass eel chasing estuary, to ford and fen, to mud and mire, and as the leaves are due to bruise, and the fruit is bound for falling, we are all compelled to move. Our busy skies and racing ocean. For me, I think the eel has kind of become this symbol of the planet. And I wrote a song about it called Glass Eel, which is loosely about this fantastic cycle that the eel goes through, but also about our place in the world. And I think there's so many parallels between the plight of the eel and our own plight, where there are more and more borders and boundaries and obstacles to cross. And that little eel that is travelling all that distance and has done for, as you say, 100 million years, that is just something that is completely beyond my comprehension. But I also find it quite reassuring, the idea that I am part of a sort of centrifuge of life, the same centrifuge that drives the eel as well.
Yes.
Here we are in our vice and our vanity, mindless of the irony that while patient science adds fact to fact, hasty man draws lines on man.